Buenos dias und herzlich willkommen bei Gate 7, deinem Podcast über Fernweh und Fotografie. In dieser Show geht es um Menschen, für die Reisen mehr ist als Spaß und Erholung. Freue dich auf praktische Tipps und Tricks, wie du tief in fremde Kulturen eintauchst und lerne, deine Abenteuer in bewegenden Bildern festzuhalten, egal mit welcher Kamera. Bist du bereit? Dann los, lass uns abheben mit deinem Gastgeber, Kai Beermann.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Gate 7 podcast, where it's all about travel and photography. As you can hear, this is another episode in English, and my guest today is Ugo Che from Italy. Ugo has always been passionate about traveling and photography. He says, travel photography is all about the people, the food, the architecture, and the culture that makes each place a special one. It mixes elements of landscape photography, portraiture, reportage, and aims to combine all these and paint a compelling picture of what it's like to live in a foreign country. Over the years, Ugo has turned photography into something more than just a hobby. He leads workshops in Italy and other places around the Mediterranean Sea. In 2015, Ugo started the Traveling Image Makers podcast, a weekly show that he co-hosts with US photographer Ralph Velasco. Together, they pick the brains of famous and not so famous travel photographers to learn what it means to travel for the love of photography and photograph for the love of travel. In this interview, Ugo shares his thoughts on exploring a foreign country with one's camera and gives plenty of advice on how to take better pictures while traveling. Thanks a lot for listening, and please enjoy my conversation with Ugo Che. Hello, Ugo. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Ugo, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. And all the people who have a passion for podcasts and travel photography, they've probably come across your name at some point because, you run a very successful podcast show. It's called The Traveling Image Makers, which you launched and you host alongside Ralph Velasco. But for all those out there who are not familiar with your name, could you please introduce yourself and, tell a little bit how you got started in photography?
Well, I'd like to say that I'm a travel photographer, which means that I do travel a lot for various reasons, not all of them having to do with photography still. But I always like to bring a camera or cameras with me and to document the places I see, the culture, the people, the landscape, the cityscapes, just to work as a memory of, to keep the memory of those places and show them to others who have not been there. I like to say that we live in a great world, and every place and every culture deserves to be seen. So I think I'm doing that. I started in photography. I can't even remember when. I mean, I've always had a camera in my hand, more or less, for many years. Then I was, for some time, I was not doing a lot of it, at least mostly casually. Then it started with the advent of digital. I was always working with computers in IT and back in the day, let's say, about 10 to 12 years ago, like in the software industry and with geeks and so on. Digital photography started becoming really popular as a hobby because digital photography required the use of a computer. And back then, they weren't as user-friendly as they were right now. Software was harder to find, harder to use, and so on. So we geeks had kind of an advantage in that, let's say. So it became very popular, and I went to conferences where people would talk about software generally. But then they organized photo walks. We wanted to do some cities around the world, and people had those photo walks. And I said, okay, maybe I should get a digital camera myself and start going on those photo walks and maybe rekindle my passion for photography. And that's what happened. So I started really getting into it. And the other thing I would say is that I'm an educator. I've always been an educator, a trainer, a teacher, again in the software world. And then I started like moving this passion, this attitude of mine into the world of photography. So now I like to say that I help people sharpen their skills so that can take amazing photographs.
Yeah.
That's kind of my mission statement.
Yeah, well, interesting journey. You divide your time and between your job in the IT and working as a photographer instructor, photography instructor. You lead tours to different places in the Mediterranean, right?
Yeah, I'd like to say that I have two full-time jobs at the moment. Because both of them are taking up so much of my time. Yeah, because I like this education aspect. I like teaching people. I like showing them.
Yeah.
Helping them get better pictures. I started leading tours. So this also goes hand in hand with my passion for travel.
Yeah. Great.
Mediterranean is where I started. Italy, of course. I'm from Italy. We have some beautiful locations here. So I've done tours in the Cinque Terre area. I've done tours in Tuscany. We're talking about this before we started the recording. I just returned from Venice, where every year it's become a tradition. I have this tour/workshop for the Carnival of Venice. And in fact, I'm just going to start planning for 2019, where I will be doing this tour again. And possibly I will also do another tour in Venice, possibly the beginning of November, which will not be for the Carnival. So no costumes, no masks, but it will also all be about the hidden, off the beaten path places in Venice where nobody or very few people go to. I mean, everybody goes to Venice. They know about San Marco. They know about Rialto, those places, the gondolas and so on. But Venice has a wealth of places where not many people go to, that not many people know about. So, in fact, I just published on my website an article, a little reportage, because I had the luck of being introduced to this guy in Venice who builds puppets, marionettes and puppets. And he's one of the few left. He does all this work by hand, creates those awesome creations, works of art, and he invited us to his workshop where we went there and photographed. So I just published an article about that. That's one of the things that I want people to know about, because they're not on the usual websites of what to go and photograph in Venice.
Yeah, and that's the advantage of going with a knowledgeable tour guide or someone who really knows the place. If you go with someone like that, you get access to, places and locations that you normally wouldn't go as a tourist, right?
Exactly. Mm. And then I also expanded a little bit beyond the confines of the Mediterranean. I've done this tour of Oman in December, and I'm going to do this again in winter next. I mean, probably either December 2018 or January 2019. It's going to be my second tour of Oman, amazing country.
Yeah, great. Lots of variety, different places, Oman and Venice, all with their special. They offer something special, different genre of travel photography that you can shoot there. In Venice, it's more architecture, it's more people photography. And in Oman, you have beautiful landscape, the sand dunes and all that. Do you have any preference in your own photography for, let's say, are you more a people photographer, or do you enjoy all different styles?
I really enjoy all. I mean, I think that travel photography, proper travel portfolio or a story, a reportage, whatever, should include many aspects of a country. So for Venice, I like to shoot the city. I like to shoot the small details. I like to shoot the people. Same with Oman. Oman is great because of the nature, the desert, the mountains, the sea, but also The people there are great. They're very open to being photographed. They love it. The history, it's a country that is rich in history. It has those amazing ancient forts and mosques, and you can go there and photograph architecture, both ancient and modern. It's a great mixture of ancient and modern. So that's really what I like. So, same for Tuscany. The landscape in Tuscany or Cinque Terre and so on is very much shaped by the hand of man. You don't really go to Tuscany for a purely natural landscape. It's not wilderness. It's agricultural landscape. It's vineyards. It's fields of grain and gently rolling hills with farms and rows of cypress trees. These are very, very anthropic landscape, as proper term, I think, is.
When you prepare for a photo trip, how do you go about that? Do you read a lot? Do you do lots of research? Or do you prefer to get to know a place once you are there?
I try to do a lot of research, especially because I typically during my tours, I don't have a lot of time. As we said, I have two jobs to manage. So I have to make the most of what little time I have, which means doing a lot of research beforehand. I can just afford to spend a week in a place and just discover it. I would love it sometimes, just especially if I'm in a city. I'd like just sometimes just wandering around and trying to discover new places. But I need to do a lot of research because I need to do the most of the time I have. So that means researching the locations, looking at the photos that people have taken there, looking at the best hours, where is the sun going to set, where is it going to rise from, and so on. So yeah, I do. Then if I go to some place for the first time, maybe myself or for a family tour, or I also do some photo walks with friends or tours with friends. I just do a little bit of scouting. I mean, I document myself, but then I wanted to see with my own eyes, so that when I'm leading people there, I'm able to actually base my guidance on something that I've personally experienced rather than somebody I found online. So for Oman, I was there for a week before leading a tour there. It was my vacation / scouting trip.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great way to go about that. And do you organize everything for those trips, from hotel bookings to transport and all these things? Or
I do organize a lot. Yeah, I do like to, because I do that also for instance, family or group vacations. I do done some vacations with large groups of friends. And I was the one, because just I enjoyed the process, trying to find, draw a route, find the best places, find the best hotels, the most fancy or traditional restaurants, and so on. Because I don't like to, typically I don't like to go where the other tourists go, find places off the beaten path. So I knew I had to do some research. And I applied this research to my tour organizer job as well. So, yes, sometimes I use the services of local tour operators and guides. I do this in Oman. I don't do this in Venice. I mean, I know Venice like the back of my hand already. I've been there dozens of times. Mm. I don't need a tour guide there. Yeah. I can be my own tour guide. Other places like Oman, yeah, I'd rather use a tour guide, and it makes everything easier.
Of course, yeah, that makes sense. Ugo, let's talk about a little bit about your own evolution as a photographer. One thing I always like to ask my guests is, do you have any artists or any photographers that hugely inspired you and influenced you on your way to become a photographer?
Oh, well, probably too many to mention. It depends on which day of the week you ask me. I gravitate towards different kind of people. Let's say I would love to be somebody like Sebastião Salgado. Or Art Wolf is another one that gives me a lot of inspiration.
Yeah, Salgado is fascinating. It's also one of my favorite photographers. There was recently a documentary on German television. I don't think it's an English documentary, but it told his story and how he got started. First, I think he had a he studied economy or
economy, yeah.
Yes,
was that the salt of the earth? No, it was actually broadcast and distributed all over the world, I think.
You were right.
I think, I saw it, it was on some channel online. I saw it online.
Yes. Yeah, it's
great movie, great documentary.
Yeah, it shows his life and how he got involved and, very his different projects and how he evolved over time and taking on new and adding on to what he'd done before and to see all that. Yeah, it's brilliant work.
I love his, those people. I mentioned Salgado, I mentioned Art Wolf. I could mention others just off the top of my head, their names escape me, but it's not just the photography. I like somebody like Salgado, their integrity. They have a very their actions, their photography is driven by their moral compass. They don't just photograph for the sake of photography. They photograph because they just love humanity. And somebody like Art Wolf is very much of a conservationist. And he does it for the love of nature. And everything he does is because of that. It's not just to take fancy pictures and publish them in great magazines like National Geographic and sell books and make a lot of money. There are deeper motives behind what they do, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's so important, or in that the examples that we talk about, it adds up, or it adds to their photography, to their whole body of work. If you go about it with, as you called it, a moral compass and with values and something you want to say with your pictures and images, it's
totally, yeah.
And when you look at pictures of these great masters, how do you go about that? How do you analyze pictures and maybe from that to abstract some techniques or about composition or lighting and all these things that you can apply to your own photography?
I don't have a specific process for that. I think for me, it's very organic and natural. It's rare for me to look at a photograph and think and say, okay, how can I get from this? I like just the pleasure, the holistic pleasure of taking it all in. And sometimes I will notice a specific cues of light, the way the light happens to fall on the subject, the composition and so on. But I just like to be surprised by that. I think I'm like to somehow unconsciously internalize that rather than thinking of consciously applying what I've seen to my own work.
It's looking at different kinds of art is very important, I think, just to take it all in, and at a certain point it'll all come or express in your find expression in your photos and without being conscious of that process.
I also tend to look a lot at non-photographic art, painting mostly. Right? Again, sometimes I take a photo or I look at a scene through my viewfinder and it reminds me of a painting I've seen. More than a photo, generally. I have more memory of great paintings than I have of great photos for whatever reason. So sometimes I see this reminds me of Van Gogh or Monet, or I have a photo that I took in San Francisco of two of those Victorian houses with a truck in front. And it reminded me with the light and so on, reminded me of the Empire of Light of René Magritte. Sometimes it's after the fact. Not when I'm taking the photo, but when I'm looking at it afterwards. I went to the American Southwest, for instance, and I see the landscape there. And I think of George O'Keefe, American painter, took a lot of those landscape, arid desert landscape in New Mexico. And I see that.
Yeah, there's so much you can take from art and to nurture your creative soul and vision.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So I would recommend everybody not just to look at the great masters of photography, but also look at the great masters of painting, visual arts in general.
Yeah, yeah, have a broader view. I think the same. Ugo, you were so kind to send me a couple of your pictures. Maybe it's a little odd to talk about something visual on a podcast, but
it's okay. I guess you will have a post on your site that goes with it, so probably you can upload the photos there and people can look at them, right?
Yes, I will put them in the show notes to this episode. And meanwhile, we try to make it as descriptive as possible so that everybody can just imagine what we are talking about and, use the images kind of to bounce off to other topics about travel photography and maybe some techniques.
Sure.
Okay, well, let's start with first picture. I think that's Cinque Terre.
If you refer to the night one, yes.
Yes, yeah. The night one. Maybe you can describe a little bit. What's
more like blue hour than night.
Mm-hmm.
If I can give a little tip to photographers. If I had taken this photo, so let's describe it, and then it will be easier for people who are just listening to visualize this. But this is the Cinque Terre region in Italy, is this area where the Cinque Terre literally means the five lands, and it refers to those five villages that are perched on cliffs on the seaside. It's all very mountainous terrain that typically drops into the sea with not much of a flat land there. So those villages are very much, or used to be very much isolated. They're hard to reach by road. There's a train line going through them. They've become really popular in recent years, but they absolutely preserved their original architecture and their look. They might look the same as they used to look 100 years ago. So this one is called Manarola. It's one of the five villages. The spot from where I took this picture. So you're watching the village from across the harbor. It's a little harbor, and the village is on a little cliff. And you looking through the harbor, you see it. And this photo was taken between maybe half an hour or to an hour, probably half an hour after sunset. That means what I call the blue hour, because the sky will be blue. It's not light blue; it's deep blue, and the lights of the village have already come up. So you get those warm lights on the houses, and those houses are all colored different hues of pastels and pinks and yellows and blues and green, with those warm street lights which contrast beautifully with the blue sky. So this is one of probably my favorite time of the day to shoot, the blue hour, after sunset or before sunrise, because you get this great contrast between city lights and the sky, which is very blue. What's my tip? I see a lot of photographs that people might have taken in the same location later during the night. Mm. Where the sky is pitch black. I pack my tripod and go away. I would pack my tripod and go away from such a place long before the sky is pitch black. Because this kind of, it almost never looks good. So my first tip would be exploit the blue hour. Cityscapes in the middle of the night when the sky is pitch black rarely look good, because the only colors you get are the orange of the city lights and the black. I don't think that's a great combination of colors. So that sometimes is can be hard on people because I hear a lot of people, oh, okay, we photographed the sunset and now we go for dinner. And I say, okay, well, you can go for dinner. I'll reach you there maybe half an hour later because now it's the time when I start really having fun. And I see a lot of people, they pack up their tripods and they go. And I said, no, I'll wait here. You can have dinner. Maybe I'll come for dessert.
Yes. Yeah, it's essential to know as a photographer about the quality of light and what it makes and how it can add to a photo. And you just described it beautifully. And it's, well, looking at this picture, it's a perfect example.
It's also easier because it's a time when the light on the buildings or on, if you have artificial light, will balance more or less with the light in the sky. So the dynamic range in the picture is actually manageable. At night, the lights in the city will be too bright, hard to control. At a bit earlier, the sky will be too bright and the ground will be too dark. So you have to resort to HDR, blending, or so on. This was one shot. Not a lot of post-processing work was necessary here.
Yes. And well, this is the picture or this view from the Cinque Terre and from this particular village. Yeah, it's almost like a postcard. View and a view that many people have photographed. And I think one of the challenges in travel photography is always to find a way to photograph something that's been photographed a lot of times in a fresh and unique way. And well, this maybe we can talk a little bit about that from your experience. How do you go about that if you have something like a very famous site? And to
First of all, I would say don't be a stickler for originality. Probably originality is overrated. One, there's a reason why postcards are popular. And why those places or those images are called iconic, because they're beautiful. There is nothing wrong with taking a photo that is of an iconic place that has been photographed many times. You should not say, okay, I don't want to take it because everybody else has already done it. Now, of course, you should always strive to find something uniquely yours. But don't just shun the iconic shot. There is also a practical reason for that. I was talking about that in a talk that I gave last year at the Out of Chicago conference. And I was giving this example of a photograph that I took in Prague, which is, again, a very, very seen a million times location where you go to a hill overlooking the river and you have this beautiful perspective of the bridges crossing the river. And again, this was a blue hour shot, so beautiful light, the city lights, the deep blue in the sky. Yeah. I've seen that photo a million times, honestly. But then I've been asked to use that photo for a jigsaw puzzle by a company that does jigsaw puzzles. And what do jigsaw puzzles, what views, what photographs do you find on them? You find the postcard shots. You don't find the unusual shot. You find a bright, colorful, beautiful light, and most importantly, very recognizable places. Because people want to buy a puzzle, a jigsaw puzzle, of a place they know, they recognize. They've been to that. They want a jigsaw puzzle of the Taj Mahal. Right, or of Cinque Terre, or of the river in Prague. So I sold that photo for a few hundred dollars. Okay, it would not be, might not be the most original picture, but it paid for a little bit of the trip to Prague. Then I took that photo, took that out of the way, and then I went looking for more off the beaten path places, which sometimes happens just I just wander around the city and I photograph anything that strikes my interest.
Mm. Yeah. Right?
And I try to show with my own eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. There's two sides to that. It's the iconic shots that sell, and that as you described it, and then maybe on a more personal level, for you can maybe focus more on the more original shots and what you encounter, just strolling the streets and going off the beaten path.
Yeah. So I always try to find. Because sometimes originality pays, so wherever I go, I was trying to find a place that I think would look great, which sometimes can be successful, sometimes not. So getting the iconic postcard shot in the can, and then thinking about something else, I think is a productive way for at least for me to go. And I understand the people who don't want to, that they always. They say, no, I don't want to take the same photo that everybody else takes. Fine. Okay. Nothing against that. That's just my way of doing things.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Then let's talk about the second image. It's from Italy. We travel to Greece now, I think.
Italy or Greece? You said it's from Italy and we travel to Greece.
No, this one from Cinque Terre, from Italy, and now off to Greece.
Okay, sorry, did I? He's honest to me. Yeah, okay, I'll describe the photo. It's the bell tower and the dome, so it's not of a church in the island of Ios in Greece.
Yes.
Which the Greek islands are really a place that I love going to again and again. Blue sky with nice white clouds. And these Greek churches are just painted this bright white and blue, especially in this area of Greece, the Cyclades Islands. The typical architecture will be whitewashed white buildings with blue roofs and domes and so on. And with the blue sky and white clouds, it's all a picture that is all in tones of white and blue. Mm-hmm. I tried here, I've shot from below, so you don't see the whole church. You only see the bell tower and the dome, mm-hmm. and then a little chapel behind it. So I went really close and I shot upwards towards the sky because I wanted striking... how would I say, strong geometric graphical composition. And I also took this photo under midday sky, really strong light during summer. Mm-hmm. One thing I want to illustrate here maybe is that you don't have to limit yourself to the golden hour, the blue hour, when the light is warm and soft. This is strong, hard light. But it works really great, in my opinion, with the subject that I also try to compose in a striking, strong geometrical, graphical way.
Mm.
That's my why I like this picture, I think.
Yeah.
Why it works.
Oh, and also this, the blue color of the dome, and it's... Yeah, you immediately recognize it, or it puts you into the place. It's so typical for Greece. So looking at the picture at first sight, you kind of know where this picture was taken, and you give this little clue.
Mm. Still, it's not a hugely popular island or spot for photography. So I think I haven't seen this particular church photograph in this particular way. So this is my little doing something original and not iconic. Even so, it's very representative of the place, as you said. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, then back from Greece to Italy.
Yeah.
This is Tuscany.
This is Tuscany. Again, we are in the... kind of the iconic, a very popular spot and photographed many, many, many times. I myself have been there with the right light at least twice. This is in the center of Tuscany, an area called Val d'Orcia. And I've been there. The last two times I've been there, there were at least 10 other photographers. And this was a sunrise. You go there at sunrise. And if you go there at sunrise in the fall, in the autumn, if you prefer, it will be fog lingering in the valleys. So you're in this little elevated place, looking down into the valley with the different layers of hills towards the horizon, with the fog in the bottom of the valley, under this farm with cypress trees, which is hit by the, as soon as the sun comes up, it will hit the scene, and the warm light will hit these undulating hills, and it will make a great effect. There will be patterns due to the vineyards, the recently plowed fields, which have their own texture and so on, which the roughness of these patterns that contrast with the softness of the fog. It was just great light on that morning. This photo and the way I processed it, when I processed it, I had in mind some paintings, not a specific one, but just the kind of color that you get from some Italian Renaissance paintings of the 1400s and so on, where the landscape started being painted this way.
Yes. Yeah, it's an amazing atmosphere.
There might have been in a Madonna or a warrior on a horse there in the middle of the scene in those paintings. But if you go beyond the main subject and you look at the landscape, the people at the time started painting the landscape in a realistic way. That was the birth of realism in landscape painting, essentially, that period of time after Giotto, starting with Piero della Francesca and other artists of that era. It's not a matter of chance that they were from Tuscany. They painted the landscape of Tuscany, and you see it today, and you see those. I see those paintings, those frescoes.
I really love what I love about this picture. As you said, this in the foreground, you have this nice texture of the fields, and then in the background, it's also soft with the fog over the rolling hills and these beautiful colors in the morning light. It's a visually very pleasing picture.
So again, a little if you allow a little technical tip here.
Sure. Yes.
This photo was taken with a telephoto lens. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the exact focal length, but it might have been around 70 millimeters or between 70 and 100. The effect of a telephoto lens is that of compressing the planes. So here you have a foreground with the farm, and then you have at least three or four different levels, layers of hillsides going off in the distance. If it were not for the fog, so the fact that the distant layers are, there is less contrast, the software, because of the fog, gives the photo its three-dimensional look. That if you had used the telephoto with harsh light, it would have been completely lost. Mm. So the haze is a clue to the distance.
Depth, yes.
To depth, exactly. Mm.
Yes, yeah. Great example. That's nice. Well, then we jump again from Italy to Oman.
Yeah. And we jump from landscapes to people.
Yes.
We haven't jumped.
Variety.
Okay, so this is a photo I took in Oman, and it's a group of people. It's five people in the photo. They were sitting on a bench, wall, not very high. They were sitting there at a place where these are workers, construction workers, and they're not Omani. Mm. If you've been to Oman, you learn to recognize the people there, the traditional Omani garb and traditional dress are completely different from this. And these people are from Pakistan. And if you go to the Gulf countries like the Emirates and Oman, most of the construction work and hand labor is not performed by the locals. It's performed by immigrant or expat workers from countries like Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh or Nepal. Mm-hmm. So there was a group of Pakistanis who were just relaxing between two shifts in the work or whatever. This little place where there is a thermal bath, so they were taking baths, relaxing in the shade and so on. And we're sitting there and I asked to take the photos. So you see those people, there is one in the front with a beard and piercing brown eyes. I really love these eyes. And his skin burnt by the strong sun, very fierce and proud look. So even though the people are somewhat far from the country, they're doing a hard job. They're probably not being paid a lot. They don't have any rights in that society. They're probably not very much respected. Mm. But they still have a lot of pride in them, I think. And they would just ask them to watch towards me, to face the camera. And then I used the wide aperture because I wanted that to have the first person really sharp and then the persons in the back a bit softer to give, again, more depth to the image through that. The light was great because they were in the shade, but it was still the light in the back. The faces were in the shade, but still the open shade would put light in their eyes. And this is very important when you photograph somebody. Make sure that they get light in the eyes, even if they're in the shade. So that really, the eyes are the gateway to the soul. And I think the eyes of, especially the first person here, reveal a lot about his, what he's thinking, what is.
Yes. Yes.
The story of his life.
He has a very strong impression, and as he described it, the focus and the open aperture, this effect that it gives, you have this person in focus, very sharp, and then in the back, with a shallow depth of field, the other persons are not in focus, but it's a beautiful composition of this man sitting there.
It's a kind of a choice whether I could have chosen to go with a narrow aperture and have everyone in focus. Mm. I don't know this is a main subject.
Yeah.
Maybe the other ones, if they had been sharp, would have somehow distracted from the main character. They act like supporting characters, which are not as important as the one in the front. But yeah, probably would have worked even with a small aperture and everyone sharp. It's unconventional, right? When you take a group portrait, you want everyone to be sharp, right? Here is a group portrait where the one in the front is sharp and the others are not.
Mm.
Yeah. I think it still works.
Yeah. But I think, the way you did it, you have the one person in full focus and with all its details, and the other characters are strong in this strong characters as well. Maybe that would have taken a little bit away from the focus. Now you see them and they have characteristic clothes on, they have some hats, but they're more reduced to these objects and not so much to the details in their faces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that I just tried. I say, let's see how this will look with a wide aperture and blurring that these other people.
Yeah.
I think I succeeded, but it was more of an experiment. Right?
Yeah, but that's the beautiful thing about photography. It's you make up the your own rules and you decide what techniques to use and how to, solve a situation that you're presented with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, great. And well, people photography on travel or on trips is always, well, something that people find very difficult or challenging to get in contact with people. Maybe you have to overcome some shyness to approach people. In this image, was there some nonverbal communication, or how did you approach the
group? So first, let me tell you that definitely, yes, I had to overcome a lot of shyness, personal, feeling awkward asking people about taking the portraits. I had to really force myself to practice it. Mm-hmm. There is no substitute for practicing. It was, if you practice that or a lot, then you will become more confident and you learn that the worst that can happen is that people will say no. And I say, okay, thanks anyway. So nothing bad will happen to you if you ask. Now, there was no... not really. Well, there was verbal communication between our guide mm-hmm. and them. Yeah. So he spoke Arabic to them mm-hmm. and translated what we wanted to achieve. That was take their photo, which they were a bit surprised because I don't think many people. This was not a tourist place. There's not many Westerners there with cameras and so on. So it was unusual for people go to those workers and ask to have their portrait taken. So they were a bit surprised, but pleasantly surprised. So we asked our guide, can you please ask them if they would allow us to take their photo? They said yes. So we did. Then we had a little bit of asking. It's always nice to... interact with your subjects in ways that go beyond just asking for a photo. So we asked for where they were from, what they were doing in Oman, if they had families at home, if they were homesick. So we had this, our guide acted as an interpreter to understand a bit about their plight, their lives.
Mm. Yes, great. Well, the last picture, again, back to Italy. Now we are in Venice.
Yeah, this is a picture that I took less than a week ago. I think it was Friday or Saturday morning. Last Friday. So I was in Venice for this Venice Carnival workshop. Is an event that is very popular with photographers, so you see a lot of photographers there. Here specifically is Piazza San Marco, or for connoisseurs of Venice, is what is called the Piazzetta, which is and part of the square that is a bit off the main square, the side of it, looking towards the lagoon with the Church of St. George in the back. On the left, we have the Doge's Palace. On the right, we have the library. So-called Biblioteca Marciana, is the ancient library of the city of Venice. So this is early morning again. I went out hoping for, it was probably our first really sunny morning in the whole week. Went out looking for great light. I knew I would find great light there because when the sun comes up, it hits the face of the building on the right, which is facing east, and it just glows orange-pink. So beautiful light there. I knew I would find it. I also knew that all the photographers would be on the seaside photographing masks, mm-hmm. people in costumes. And if you look at the photo, there's a crowd at the end of the pavement of the square, and they're all there photographing other people with masks. And I said, I just don't want to go there because it's kind of a crowded and everybody's elbowing for their chance to take a photo of the most beautiful mask. As I told you before, we like to, when we organize this tour, we typically tend to avoid those situations for our students. We organize private shoots in hotels or palaces or other places, so there's not a crowd that you have to contend with mm-hmm. or behind closed doors. So I was not there to photograph masks. I was there to photograph the city. Little funny story here. I was initially standing in the middle of the square And I was wearing a bright yellow jacket, which sometimes I use to, when I go to crowded places, to be seen by my students. When otherwise, they might get lost and see, where is our instructor? Oh, it's the guy with the bright yellow jacket. So I was there in the middle of the square with this my yellow jacket, and I set my tripod down. And then somebody came to me and tapped on my shoulder. Said, "Do you speak English?" I said, "Yeah, sure." He said, "Would you mind moving away from this place? Because if you look behind, there's like a dozen photographers with their tripod."
Okay.
For the sunrise, it was in the middle of the picture. And I said, "Okay, we're taking a long exposure, so we don't mind about people in dark clothes moving across our picture. We cannot control that. But one guy with a bright yellow jacket standing there ruin our picture. So if you don't mind, would you mind walking, stepping back?" I said, "Oh, sure." So I turn around. I see that row of tripods. And you can see them at the right of my picture. So I said, "Okay, I will not go there. I will move even further back and just get the whole square in." And I used here as kind of a central composition, you know, rule of thirds and all those things. But sometimes I like a central composition, especially in this case. You have two buildings on the side, the two columns on the middle. So I went for really that vertically that the photo is really centered. And I think it works with this kind of symmetrical subject. The perspective of the square is leading towards the center. I think it's just better this way than just using the old tired rule of thirds.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Sometimes you just have to break these rules or choose a composition or a centrical composition as you did in this case. I think it really works.
I think that again that the scene itself is not overly original. It's just about the light.
Yeah.
This photo is about the light.
Yeah. The beautiful, beautiful light, a place that in itself is amazingly beautiful. And then this amazing morning light adds to that and makes it even more beautiful, these buildings.
I didn't even want to get up that morning because the forecast was for clouds, a little bit of clouds. And I said, well, but I just was awake at 5 a.m. after trying to... rolling in my bed, trying to sleep again. I said, "Okay, well, whatever. I'm not going to sleep anymore. I'm just going to go out and see what I can get." It paid off.
it really paid off. Yes, it's as it often does. You think it's not going to be a very good day for shooting, but then once you get up and you get surprised, and this was the reward.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, great. Nice. Beautiful pictures, Ugo. And I think, we tapped on some very interesting tips on travel photography. Adding to that, what do you think are, of course, travel photography is such a broad field, but what are some basic rules, I think, that from your experience that make up good travel photography, and that someone going on a trip can easily apply to come home with better pictures?
So my first rule of travel photography, I mean, it sounds a bit obvious, but it is that in order to do travel photography, you have to travel.
Yes.
I see too many people that say, "I will travel when I have time. I will travel when I retire. You have to travel. You have to explore the world." Some people are just too tied to their place and don't travel enough. That's one thing. The other thing is always carry a camera with you. It goes without saying, but I see people that just travel to places and leave the camera home. I've seen people that go travel to places, they carry their camera with them inside their bag with the lens cap on and the camera off. And I say, why did you even bring your camera? If something happens, something interesting, you have to open your bag, take the camera out, take the lens cap off, turn the camera on, figure out what settings you left it in, and then take a photo, and then maybe the magical moment is gone. You go out with the camera slung across your shoulder, in your hand, whatever you want to carry it with, ready to shoot. Okay, so that's the second tip. Another one, which might be a little bit standing contrast to what I just said, don't always keep the camera to your eye. Don't look at the world always through the viewfinder. Spend at least some time every day observing the place where you are without the camera. Just absorb it. Unless we are on assignment. Let's say, okay, if I'm on assignment and people have commissioned me to take photos of a specific place, then I had to get the job done. And all I have in my mind is taking photos. Mm-hmm. But most people don't travel and take photos as a job. They do it as a part of a vacation because they have they're amateur photographers. So we take photos, or they take photos, or some, and that's what I do a lot for. As a kind of a memory. I mean, we want to remember, we want to use photos to remember ourselves, relive the experiences that we had. And those experiences are visual. Those experiences are based on smell, the sound. And even if those experiences are visual, what we see with our eyes is much richer than what the restricted view that we have, that we can see through the viewfinder. It's a very narrow view. It's like a tunnel view. If your eyes are constantly on the viewfinder, there's a lot that you don't see. And you're so taken up with the idea of taking a photo and framing and so on, and what are the camera settings that I need to use and so on and so forth, that you don't hear the sounds, you don't sniff the smells, you don't touch. Your other senses are a little bit not as active as they should be. So you end up with lots of photos, and then you look at the photos and you say, where I was when I took this photo. I can't even remember. I don't remember how that place looked like. I don't remember how it sounded like. I don't remember how it smelled like. So if your photo, you want your photos to be, trigger memories of those places, you need to have memories of those places in the first place.
Yeah, very important.
Which is the repetition of words, right? So first you need to have experiences, and then you need to use photos. The photos are not the experiences. The photos are a mean to recover, to recall, and live again those experiences. Mm-hmm. So don't always have the camera to your eye. Learn to observe. Take in the place, just walk around, talk to people. Don't talk to people with the camera between you and them. Mm. Talk to people without the camera. Ask them about their lives. Go to a store, look at what they sell, ask what the price is, haggle, whatever. Go to a place where the locals go eat and try something new. Then maybe take a photo of your plate. Yeah, sure. For Instagram works great, but don't just spend all your time at the restaurant photographing your plates, your plate, your dishes.
Yes. Yeah, that's great advice. I agree with all you said. Just take in the place with all your senses and to get that experience, and then later on try to find a way to capture that with your camera, but don't experience your whole trip through the viewfinder.
Another suggestion that I always give to my students, whenever you go to a place, especially if a new place, and you think this is an important trip and you want great images from it, or you go to a workshop, learn how your camera works. Mm-hmm. Learn really well how your camera works.
Yes.
Because when you see a great scene, you see fleeting light, you see something happening on the street, and you want to capture that, and you have to figure out how to change your aperture, shutter speed, ISO, focus mode, whatever. And I see people going into menus to change the shutter speed. Okay, you should be able to find a dial that changes the shutter speed and operate on it without even looking at the camera. That's extremely important. Learn how to use your camera and practice. It's a bit painful. I mean, not for me, for them, to see people really struggling with the controls of the camera when they should focus on the scene, thinking about the composition, the light, what they want to. I mean, when you're in front of a scene, you experience something. Mm. You want to put into the scene something of you. You want to convey the emotions that scene gave you. This picture in Venice, the emotion was, wow, the light is amazing. Okay. The emotion is not, oh, damn, where do I set my ISO because the shutter speed is too low and I'm hand-holding, I need to increase the ISO. Oh, I don't know how to change the ISO. This is the emotion that you want to convey? I don't think so. So I don't want to say this to somehow complain about that's not my intent. I'm not complaining about this thing. I'm telling you, this is for you. You want to convey emotions. You want to capture experiences. You don't want to be sidetracked by technical issues like camera settings. This should be second nature. Yeah, I see a scene. Well, like this scene in Venice. Okay, what do I need? Everything, I've got a foreground, everything is in the long distance. I need a small aperture to have a great depth of field. I will focus about a third into the photo to get the optimal depth of field. And I'm going, the light is really marginal. I have a small aperture, so I need slow shutter speed. I'll use my tripod. Everything of this should be pretty much unconscious. You should not consciously think about this. It should come as second nature. The moment it comes, you're really able to think about the emotions that this scene gives you. Otherwise, you'd be sidetracked.
Mm. Yeah, you miss out so much, and especially if you go on a photo tour or a workshop, as you mentioned, if you deal with that kind of issues, it's just unfortunate. These things you should get familiar with before, and learn how to operate your camera.
Because in a workshop, I will teach my students how to look at the light, how to recognize good light. If you're photographing people, how to have them face in a certain direction so that the light on their face is optimal.
It's not about the technical. Things,
or I might tell you, okay, in these situations, use fast enough shutter speeds because things are moving fast or stuff like that. I'm not going to tell you how to change the controls on your camera because I might not even know your camera. If you ask me how do I set the auto ISO on my Sony Alpha 7, I have no idea. Yeah. I never used that camera. I'm sorry. I can't help you there.
Oh, yeah. That's good advice. Just, learn how to...
Yeah.
Operate your camera.
Even if you're not doing a workshop, just for yourself, it's very important for your own benefit.
Yes. You said, in order to do good travel photography, you have to travel. But many people find it hard to photograph in their own backyard. Most of people have like a couple of weeks, a year that they can use for travel. They have their jobs and all that. And if they leave their camera untouched during the rest of the year, you kind of lose a little bit you have to practice, I think. That's the important thing. If you go on a trip two or three times a year and then take your camera, you need always so much time to get into the flow again. And so...
Yeah. So honestly, I don't like to photograph in my own backyard. I think everybody, many people have this, right? Their own backyard, my city, where I live and so on, they look not very interesting to me. Sometimes I do, but I'm not often very inspired by that. So, I try sometimes to force myself to do it because I know I have to keep on my toes, to keep my skills fresh. What I do, even if I don't have 2 weeks to travel, I only might have 2 weeks to travel during the whole year. I understand many people have that. I think we in Europe are a bit lucky compared to our American friends because personally, I have 5 weeks of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how it works in Germany if you're an employee, but it's pretty much the same, right? Between 4 and 5 weeks.
Yeah.
But sometimes people, even if they have those weeks, they might have small children and other stuff. So, and traveling can be expensive, of course. What I do when I cannot travel is I travel close. Maybe it's just a weekend. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I go to a city close. Again, I'm lucky as an Italian to live in Italy, where we have everywhere is full of art and beautiful cities with palaces, medieval cities, architecture, churches, and so on. I can drive 1 or 2 hours, spend a weekend. I can drive 3 hours, go to Florence, spend a weekend there, and go back, leave Friday night or Saturday morning, and go back on Sunday night. I don't have to take days off work for that. I try to take part every little photo walk that there is around me. I try to take part in it, even if it's just the morning in Milan. That's travel. We're in Europe. We are lucky because we can fly across most of Europe with those cheap airlines. So last year I've been to, I don't know, I said, well, I got... France, I got, what was that? Trey Ratcliffe was doing his European tour and he was in Berlin. And I said, well, it would be nice to visit Berlin. I've already been there. Would like to, nice to go back. I might take my family. So flight to Berlin was like 60, 70 euros. Mm. I mean, yeah, and I said, let's go to Berlin one weekend. Saturday and Sunday, I went to Paris to meet my friend Valerie Jardin. She was doing a photo walk there.
Yes.
For a weekend.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, it costs money, can be relatively cheap, but it doesn't cost a lot of time. You can.
Yeah.
Many people can do that. Yeah. And okay, Paris is a bit far away, can be costly. Getting a hotel or even Airbnb in Paris can be expensive. As I said, I can go to not Florence, but a small, went to recently to Lucca, which is a not very widely known town in Tuscany. I can drive there and it's beautiful. It's got, it's a medieval town, still with the ancient city walls, Gothic churches and palaces, like a medieval wonder. I can go there for 2 days. Easily, even in Germany, I mean, there are some beautiful cities that you can reach. Spain, France, the same. They are our backyard.
Mm. Yeah, extend your own backyard a little bit, even if it's just a few kilometers to travel to a nearby city that you haven't been to. There's, no excuse to miss out on some practice. And
short range and short time, I mean... like weekend travel is available to everyone nowadays.
Doesn't have to be long. Doesn't have to be long distance all the time. And
you don't have to go to Oman to for that.
No, right. Most important thing is, to be curious, I think, and have the hunger to explore new surroundings, new places with your camera.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Ugo, at the end, let's talk a little bit about your podcast. What is it? Is it about? It's once a week, right?
It is. This show is called The Traveling Image Makers. I started this myself. Then later, I joined forces with my friend Ralph Velasco, which is another great travel photographer, even more experienced about travel and travel photography than myself. We've been publishing an episode every week for more than 2 years. We just published our 115th episode.
Wow.
And I pride myself to say that we never skipped an episode.
Mm-hmm.
One every week.
That's
so that's been 115 weeks. It's typically an interview show. Most of the times we interview a guest. who is a photographer, travel photographer. We might talk about a destination. We might talk about the projects that they're doing. I love to talk about things like, again, conservation, social issues, and so on, or sometimes just about how beautiful some places are, maybe a little bit of technique and so on, but a bit of everything. We also have this contest. We have a Facebook group. It's called the Traveling Image Makers Corner. And you can just go to ttim.photo/Facebook. You find our Facebook group. You can join. It's free. We have this contest. You can submit a photo. And if you, we will pick two winners every 2 months, and we invite them on the show to talk about their photo. You don't have to be a professional, and you don't have to pay a dime for this. Just submit your photo, and you might be on the show. So that's what I do. I started doing one day. I said, what could I do to do something different? I could do a podcast. Everybody's doing a podcast these days. I said, let's see how it works. It would just took me maybe a 1 week between conception and having my first episode published. I just dived into it.
Wow.
And I said, I have no idea what it takes, but I'll just do it.
That was quick.
Yeah.
1 week.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, yeah. Maybe a week or so.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. And you're a podcast listener yourself. Do you enjoy listening to other podcasts?
I've been listening to podcasts, for a long time. I do it typically when I'm running, jogging, driving, or on a plane or on a train. And I've been I was a longtime listener of The Candid Frame with Guy Baron Exparello, Tweep, which recently went back from hibernation, so I'm really looking forward to to listening to that. Not only photography, I listen to some shows about business, because, well, let's face it, I try to make a living for photography also, so I want to learn about business and self-improvement, other shows like those.
Yeah. Yeah, podcast is a great resource, and your show is, I can only recommend it to everyone interested in travel photography who hasn't listened to it. Check it out. It's wonderful interviews, interesting guests you have on the show, and always look forward whenever a new episode comes out.
Thank you very much. Oh, another thing I would like to give a shout out to my friend Valerie Jardin and her Hit the Streets podcast, which is just awesome, especially if you're into street photography.
Yeah. It's also been a huge inspiration for me, and I love her show, and I was lucky to have her on my show as well, and she's a great person.
Mm. Yeah.
How important do you think is community building among photographers? You with your podcast and your Facebook group, you're very active in that, building a community yourself. Can you describe a little bit what that means to you, to be in contact with other photographers from around the world?
It means a lot to me. I like reaching out to people as much as I can, and just having lots of connections and relationships and so on. In a way, it's just because it's just fun. And it's fun for me to go to, whenever I have something, a trip planned to some place, I always try to look who between my online friends or real life friends lives close by. And I get in touch with them and I say, I'm coming to your city, any chance? We can have a little photo walk, we can have beers, a coffee together, whatever, just meet in person maybe, and that's always been a great thing. Another thing is the aspect of networking, which is very closely related to business. I think it's many photographers, or probably many creatives, don't really like or understand the aspect of networking and how networking can help in your profession, in your business. And other people, they do kind of understand that they need to network in order to get opportunities. but I see it in a very self-serving way. So my approach to networking is, when you approach somebody, don't think about what they can do for them. Always think about what you can do for them, right? I also talked about this during a talk I gave again at the Out of Chicago conference. Do you remember that movie Glengarry Glen Ross, where there's this great scene where Alec Baldwin is this seasoned salesman who explains about how to close the sale, and he has this. His mantra is ABC, which stands for always be closing. You should always think about closing the deal. Now, if you approach your community as a way to find the members of your community as leads, your connections as somebody that you have to sell to or help you selling, you're taking it the wrong way. My mantra is always be giving. Always think about what you can give, and you will get back in spades. Well, sometimes you ask, because even asking is a way of giving, because asking is a way to make feel people important. If you ask somebody, I mean, that people are typically willing to help, and they're happy when they're asked for help. They feel important. And they are important, I mean, I want to say. So ask, but always think in terms of what can I give to those people? And don't keep score. Another thing is, if people ask you for a favor, they might not always reciprocate. So some people might approach you when you have a network. That happened to me. Say, can you introduce me to so-and-so? Say, sure, no problem, and I will. Then sometimes I will ask them, can you introduce me to this one of your connections? They might not reciprocate. There might be many reasons why they do so. They might not feel, they don't know that people well. They might think they might be embarrassed by it, but for whatever reason, they might not do it. And then they come back to you again and ask for something else. And some people say, oh, this person asked me a favor once. I asked me a favor and he gave me nothing. And then he's asking me a favor again. We're not even. Before I gave him a favor, I want to be even. That's wrong. Don't keep score.
Don't approach it that way.
No, just, I mean, if it doesn't cost anything to you, just give.
Yeah.
Some people will end up exploiting you. And then you start to learn that those people are just freeloaders. And then you cut them off.
Yeah.
There's no reason to just try to keep score. And if we're not even, I'm not going to give you another favor until we're even. That doesn't make any sense, to me at least.
No, to me neither. And it tells more about the other person than about yourself. So it's you always, if you approach it with a serious interest and try to build a network and in an honest way, you'll benefit from that later on. Yeah, whether it's for business interest or private interest, what you mentioned in the beginning, that using this network when you travel to have friends and colleagues in different places around the world, that's so valuable. If you go on a trip and have someone, let's say, whatever, I want to go to Prague and know someone in Prague who I can go on a photo walk with and show me around places that I wouldn't have discovered myself. So that's just, I think, the great reason to get involved in photo communities.
So I also created this, you mentioned it before, the Traveling Image Makers Corner, which is a Facebook group, which is open to anyone who wants can join, as long as they have at least a passing interest in travel photography or even photography at large.
Yes.
And in all honesty, the reason I created the group was to keep my podcast listeners engaged. I have another way to get in touch with them, to keep in, because you throw out the podcast and you never know who is listening. Unless they get back to you, which very rarely happens, they write you an email, they leave you a review and say it was great, thanks for this and so on. But that's a small minority. So the Facebook group is also another way to keep those people engaged and so on. But it's not a way, I don't think of those people as prospects or leads.
No, okay? You shouldn't.
I don't treat them as such. I don't calculate my ROI on the Facebook group. I don't compute the engagement and ask them to buy something. Yeah, if I have an announcement of something I'm doing, like a new tool.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I will post it to the group.
Yes.
Yeah. Not because I expect people to. I will not complain if they don't care.
Great. Hugo, we talked about your podcast and about your website. Is there any other place on the internet that people can find out more about you or something else you'd like to mention?
So the podcast, which we mentioned at first, is at TTIM, which is the Traveling Image Makers .photo, photo, very easy to remember. My website is ucphoto.me. Get my initials, ucphoto.me. We talked about my tours and workshops. I don't want to list them all. I have quite a number of them lined up for this year, including Milan, Cinque Terre, Sardinia, and Venice and Oman again. I have a tours section, which is just at ucphoto.me/tours. What else? I'm on Facebook with my name, Hugo Che. I'm on Instagram as Hugo Che. I'm on Twitter, even though I don't use that much. I used to be on sites like Flickr and 500px, but I don't expect to engage with me anymore. It just takes too much time, too much of my time. I decided to mostly stick to the website and Facebook.
And
a little bit of Instagram.
Yeah, you have to limit yourself to a few social media channels, I think. If you play on all of them, you don't, well, it's impossible.
I used to be a lot on Google Plus. That was
That's not so big anymore, is it?
It's basically nobody cares anymore. I don't know. It was just a great place. I mean, a lot of the friends I've made that I have on Facebook, I made them initially on Google Plus. We just moved to Facebook where everybody else is. It's a bit of a pity because it had things going for it that were... Facebook is just such a random place. Google Plus was designed about this concept of shared interests, right? So I use Facebook to keep in touch with my photography friends. If you go to my Facebook personal page, you will notice I don't talk about my family. I don't talk about my other job. I don't talk about politics, religion, sports, or anything. I talk about photography. I want to use it to keep in touch with other photographers, to foster, to cultivate this community of photographers. With Google Plus, it was very easy to limit my interactions with photographers and to photography topics or travel topics. With Facebook, it's impossible not to have people rant about politics and get them in your stream, ranting about politics, about sports, about what they had for dinner, or their cat is sick, which I'm really sorry about, but yep, it's not that I really care that much. My Facebook is just a little thin slide. I want to be really open about this. If people engage with me on Facebook, don't expect to see the real me, at least on my public posts. It's the photographer. It's Hugo Chai, the photographer.
That makes sense.
Now, of course, if you are my friend there and privately you want to talk about something else because you think it's important, I'm always open to
there's other ways.
That. I will not post publicly about that.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Well, Hugo, it was lots of fun talking about travel photography with you. I appreciate all the time you took for this interview. And if you ever come to Hamburg, let me know.
That was another one of the weekend trips I wanted to do. I have a couple of friends in Hamburg.
Yeah.
Last summer, I had said, okay, I was just bored, probably. And I told my family, why don't we go somewhere in Europe? Let's see which is the cheapest destination that we can go on this weekend. Turned out we could fly to Hamburg for 63 euros. I said, okay, let's go to Hamburg. Unfortunately, my wife had to work that weekend.
Yeah, another time, and just let me know. But beware of the weather here. It's always pretty bad.
I know, but I mean, it was really hot in Italy. It was like mid of summer. So I said, let's go somewhere cooler.
Well, great. Thank you once again. And well, I hope to meet you in person one day.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Of course, if I come to Hamburg or if I go, you know, if I go to some place like to have a photo walk somewhere in Europe, I will typically share about it on Facebook or Instagram or so on. So keep an eye on what I'm doing, and you know where I am. And if you want to come to Italy, and everybody, I mean, not just you personally, but everyone who is listening to this, you want to come to Italy and you're there for a weekend, especially if it's somewhere like Milan, which is close, and you want to go around, let me show you some of my secret spots. Let's do a little photo walk together. Let's have a beer, a pizza, whatever. I'm always open to those kind of things.
Excellent.
Well, camera in hand, we'll explore the city or the countryside.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a good idea. Well, Ugo, thank you very much, and take care.
Okay, thanks for having me again, and all the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, this was my conversation with Italian travel photographer Ugo Che. If you enjoyed this interview, please head over to artofcreativephotography.com. This is my English website about photography, and I'll soon launch a podcast only in English on that site as well. So you can subscribe to the newsletter, and I'll let you know when the new show goes live. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in next time. Bye-bye.